Today is Thursday, August 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a retired four-star general responds to the president's threat of revoking security clearances.
It's not going to change what I choose to say or write or think.
President Trump downplays legal trouble after a conviction and guilty plea from two former associates. A top army general in Afghanistan says progress is being made, but not everyone agrees. Also ahead, after a long hiatus, singer Janet Jackson is out with a new single and an upcoming album. It's all on today's International Edition. The Trump White House went on the defensive on Wednesday, a day after two former close associates of the president became convicted felons. Former Trump attorney Michael Cohen pleaded guilty to campaign finance law violations in connection with hush money payments to two women who said they'd had affairs with Trump. Also, former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort was convicted of fraud charges unrelated to the 2016 presidential campaign. As VOA national correspondent Jim Malone reports, the two legal bombshells are likely to add to President Trump's political woes ahead of a crucial midterm congressional election in November.
At the White House, Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders stood by the president's assertion that he did nothing wrong.
As the president has stated on numerous occasions, he did nothing wrong. There are no charges against him in this. And just because Michael Cohen made a plea deal doesn't mean that that implicates the president on anything.
In court Tuesday, Cohen said he was acting on orders from then presidential candidate Trump when he paid off two women to keep them quiet shortly before the election. Cohen's attorney, Lanny Davis, said his client may also have information related to the Russia probe, led by special counsel Robert Mueller.
It's my observation that what he knows, that he witnessed, will be of interest to the special counsel. That's my opinion. We'll see.
At a rally in West Virginia Tuesday, Trump again blasted the news media and the Russia probe.
Fake news and the Russian witch hunt. We got a whole big combination. Where is the collusion? You know, they're still looking for collusion. Where is the collusion?
Trump's supporters, like Patty Beavers, are sticking with him.
He's putting America first. He's keeping his promises, just like he said. And I really believe that he will continue on.
Democrats were eager to highlight a new line of attack in the wake of the Cohen and Manafort cases, led by Senate leader Chuck Schumer.
What a swamp. What a swamp. Far worse than the swamp that existed when President Trump took over. He has not cleaned the swamp. He has made it more wretched and more fetid.
The legal cloud hovering above the Trump White House appears to be darkening, says analyst Laura Brown.
There is a sense that momentum is building in both, you know, special counsel Mueller's case, but also with regard to sort of the more questions around corruption and the president, which was revealed with Michael Cohen's plea.
There's also the sense of an embattled president fighting on several fronts at once, says Julie Pace.
We don't know what this will mean for Trump's presidency. We don't know if we will see Republicans and voters turn their back on him. But this is a more serious situation than I think he has found himself in at earlier points in his presidency.
But the legal and political fallout is still a long way from being determined, says Paul Schiff Berman.
Does that mean that he will be impeached? Not necessarily. That's a political process. Does that mean that his supporters will stop supporting him? Not necessarily. That's a question of politics as well.
And speaking of politics, it's now clear that the legal problems involving Cohen and Manafort will be an issue in the November congressional elections where Democrats are favored to make gains. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Well, the fallout from President Trump's decision to revoke the security clearance of former Central Intelligence Agency Director John Brennan continues. More than 175 former high-level State Department and Pentagon officials added their names to a statement signed by former national security officials criticizing Trump's decision. He said last week he was considering withdrawing clearance from a current Justice Department official as well as other former high-ranking officials. One of them is our next guest. Joining us now is retired Air Force General Michael Hayden, who's also a former director of the National Security Agency and Central Intelligence Agency. Your name is on the list of other high-level officials whose security clearance the president is apparently reviewing following the decision to revoke former CIA Director John Brennan's clearance. Your reaction to being on the list and that there is a list at all?
Well, I mean, the fact that John has had his clearance pulled, the way I choose to describe that is that he has had something taken away from him that he would otherwise have, and it was taken away from him for political speech, which really is kind of scary. And so, in broadest principle, I'm with John and saying this is unacceptable behavior by the government, the president of the United States. Now, with regard to my being on the list, however it works, they make the choice as to who they want to threaten. And whether I'm on the list, off the list, with a clearance, without a clearance, it's not going to change what I choose to say or write or think.
The intelligence community really across the board historically, and for that matter, you know, the military, has been pretty politically neutral. So it seemed even more striking that so many former intelligence and national security officials signed statements in support of Brennan and denouncing the decision to rescind his security clearance. Why is this situation so different that so many people felt compelled to speak out?
So we made it clear that what John said and how he said it was John's decision. And nothing we said was to be construed as in support of or not in support of. There were a range of views. But we all agreed that what the president had done was a misuse of the clearance process. There are 13 criteria, according to executive order, for removing a clearance. John's behavior doesn't begin to touch any of the 13. And so we viewed this, and the McCraven letter, Bill McCraven, the former Joint Special Operations Commander, points this out quite clearly, that it's not just John's clearance, but a whole host of things that seem to be busting the norms that have governed the American presidency for certainly most of our lifetime. And so it was a case where, although the norm for us has been to remain quiet in the public domain, the norm busting going on in the administration was so great that I think we collectively decided that this was a case where we had to act inconsistent with past practice and make the point because of how dangerous we thought both this specific action and the whole pattern of activity was.
You mentioned dangerous. The longer-term implications, what are they for the U.S. intelligence community and for our national security?
The president's action threatening a group, taking the clearance away from John, was a message to the American intelligence community and other truth-tellers in and outside of government that, given the opportunity, this president will punish you for saying things with which he disagrees or simply for saying things that make him unhappy. That's not how a democracy works. And the president, although he has great authority, and in this case, I freely admit, he's the ultimate authority when it comes to clearances. To use them for this purpose is unarguably a misuse.
Do you think it's creating any potential political polarization in our intelligence community or within the ranks of the military? And if so, what would that do?
So with the people still on active duty, I'm sure their leaders are telling them, we have nothing to do with what John Brennan says. We have nothing to do with what the president does. We'll stick to our blocking and our tackling. We'll do what it is we do to keep America safe. Now, all that said, you've got a lot of people in the retired community who no longer are actively involved in the day-to-day tasks, who've gone out of their way, done something non-traditional because they think what is going on now is so threatening, not just to John, to me, to the small group that's been threatened, but to the broad process of how we govern ourselves. Look, I said on air recently, you know, espionage is frequently conducted by doing some morally ambiguous things. I mean, even like trying to create a source inside a foreign government as his own sense of moral ambiguity. It takes its legitimacy, its justification, only because it is done in the service of a higher moral purpose. And I think most of us were saying in that letter, this question of the United States government acting on behalf of higher moral purposes was under assault because of the behavior of this administration. So although what we said may have made life a little more difficult for the people still inside government, we think they were saving, we were saving them from an even worse fate, that they would be called on to do the kinds of things they do without that higher moral purpose.
And it would appear the president made the decision without seeking advice or letting his close advisors know, some of them anyway. He certainly, as you mentioned, has the constitutional right. Has something like this, though, ever been done before without seeking the advice of those?
It's never been done before with or without advice. You're absolutely right. He didn't talk to Dan Coats, the director of National Intelligence. Didn't talk to Gina Haspel, director of the Central Intelligence Agency. He did it based upon what David Ignatius, who's a very good writer about the American intelligence community, calls the iron whim of the Oval Office. He did it. He did it alone. He did it without consultations. It's quite remarkable. Just think, you have not heard a syllable out of CIA other than we don't comment on such matters. And the director of national intelligence, when asked this, his office responded, the president has absolute authority when it comes to clearances. No attempt to justify, no attempt to explain, no attempt to join consensus. That the thin thread of those answers speaks volumes.
For those who are concerned about our democracy with the state of our political affairs, what would you say to them?
Actually, it's a pretty easy answer. Vote.
All right. Retired General Michael Hayden, who also served as director of the National Security Agency, thank you so much for being with us. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Russia braces for the impact of U.S. sanctions. Kabul and the U.S. reject. Kabul rejects. Moscow's hosted Afghan peace talks. The Taliban will attend. The U.S. Navy moves its fleet, as a hurricane bears down on Hawaii. And Israel advances plans for 1,000 West Bank settlement homes. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The commander of U.S. and international forces in Afghanistan, U.S. Army General John Nicholson, said the Trump administration's strategy for the war-torn country is yielding progress, despite no significant changes on the battlefield and several deadly Taliban attacks.
Within 6 months, we had 2 peace offers on the table, an open letter from the Taliban to the American people, and President Ghani's peace offer. Then within 10 months, we had the first ceasefire, which unleashed these social pressures, the demand of the Afghan people across all society for peace. And now we're entering a window where a second ceasefire has been offered, not taken yet. But the point is to enable a political dialogue to begin.
He said the Taliban now has the incentive to negotiate and calls it an unprecedented opportunity for peace right now. But some analysts, like Christine Fair, Associate Professor of Security Studies at Georgetown University, are skeptical of Nicholson's optimistic assessment.
I think he is out of his mind. I have a lot of respect for General Nicholson. I've known him for many years. But these statements, and in fact, he's made a number of preposterous statements since Trump became president, I can see no basis for them in reality. They are just simply baseless. They're an extraordinary statement, and not in a good way.
2017 to 2018, Taliban control of the Afghan population has grown slightly from 9% to 12%, with about a quarter of the population living in areas contested by the Taliban and the Afghan government. An ethnic Chinese Buddhist woman has been sentenced to 18 months in prison under Indonesia's blasphemy laws after she complained back in 2016 about a mosque's loud daily calls to prayer near her house in North Sumatra. 44-year-old Meliana's lawyer plans to appeal. The court said the woman's complaint triggered riots that resulted in the ransacking of Buddhist temples by Muslim mobs. The rights group Amnesty International called for a reversal of this injustice and Meliana's immediate and unconditional release. Peter McCauley is an author and economist who heads the Indonesian project at the Australia University, National University. He told VOA's Victor Beatty that this is a case when a local matter is suddenly magnified because it's seen as a violation of the country's constitutional guarantees of freedom of speech and religion.
This has to be seen as a local issue. It often reflects tension at the local level in a community. It looks as if there has been some tension between Islamic groups and Chinese Buddhist groups. And it's an issue that has blown up. The issue is about the excessive noise from the mosques. That's an issue that is a constant issue in Indonesia. Many people, including Muslims, object to the call to prayer from mosques that is too loud and too frequent. And in this case, it seems to have blown up and has unfortunately gone to court. And now there is an issue as to whether or not the person charged is subject to blasphemy.
Her lawyer says she will appeal. But activists have said that the country's blasphemy laws are being used to bully minorities and violate religious freedom. Do you subscribe to that?
It's hard to tell. It is true that Islamic groups have been more active in recent years. There was a famous case a couple of years ago where the mayor of Jakarta, a fairly popular mayor of Jakarta, who was also Chinese, whose local name, everyone knew him by the name of Ahok, Ahok made some rather tough comments, and they were interpreted as blasphemy, and Islamic groups became extremely militant and in the end forced Ahok both from office and indeed got him convicted. He is now in jail. That is most unfortunate. It certainly seems to have national political implications because just a little over a week ago, the Indonesian president, who is widely known as Jokowi, that's a nickname, made a fairly conservative selection for a man to be his running mate as vice president in the presidential elections due next year. And this is widely interpreted as Jokowi being seen to be under pressure to give ground, as it were, to conservative Islamic groups.
Apparently, there are some mosques in Indonesia that go beyond just playing the azan or call to prayer, but many also play lengthy versions of prayers or sermons that last over half an hour, and there are efforts by the government to try to rein that in.
And as I say, it is fairly widely agreed, including amongst Muslims, that the noise is excessive. The current vice president of Indonesia, whose name is Yusuf Kalla, and he is a Muslim, and he has in the past appealed to Islamic groups. He has chosen his words carefully. He has asked them to use their loudspeakers wisely.
Another incident last week involved a Facebook video of a parade on Friday in East Java, in which young children were dressed in black and seen marching in mock weapons. In May, a Muslim couple and their three children blew themselves up during an attack on a police station in the Javanese port city of Surabaya. Authorities are searching for the person responsible for uploading the video, saying he misrepresented the purpose of the parade. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
VOA's International Edition continues. All around the world, 2.6 million newborns die within a month after they're born, according to the World Health Organization. The majority of these deaths happen in developing countries where there is a lack of health care. A project called Nest 360 in the Rice 360 Institute for Global Health in Houston is trying to reduce the number of preventable newborn deaths in sub-Saharan Africa. The key is to provide appropriate medical devices for hospitals in this region of the world. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has more.
An internship at a hospital in Malawi was an eye-opening experience for Sonia Sosa.
Sometimes there are tons of babies and there are not that many nurses, so they're understaffed. It was really hard to work there, but then it also challenged me to really go back and work really hard to be able to provide this care that is accessible to them.
Sosa is one of several global health fellows who are developing technologies such as this one called IncuBaby. Yeah.
Basically, it's a warming crib
to help the most vulnerable patients in the hospitals of sub-Saharan Africa, such as Malawi.
immensely tiny, tiny newborns with only the bare minimum of technology, if anything, available to them.
17 technologies have been identified, and together they can help prevent the top causes of newborn deaths, such as pneumonia and preterm birth in this part of the world.
Our students developed a solution that would cost on the order of hundreds of dollars, and not only address the fact that it needed to be robust and cost-effective, but also easy to maintain and repair should something happen.
Countries like Malawi have received donations of medical equipment in the past, but they were not always helpful.
I saw that all the devices coming as donations from first world countries, they didn't fit in there. People used it differently, put them in weird places, and when they broke, there was no spare parts.
These devices ended up collecting dust and becoming useless because they were not right for the environment.
That engineers, doctors, nurses aren't necessarily familiar and or trained with them unless they were gone to a Western school where they've been exposed to some of these technologies, but maybe in even more complex forms. So there was a systemic change that needed to be addressed.
Part of that change includes developing technologies that monitor the temperature and the respiratory rate of a newborn while also being low cost and sustainable over time.
For the harsh environments, it includes inconsistent electricity and also a very dusty environment, lack of maintenance and spare parts.
We're in some cases incorporating battery power where it's appropriate, and then in other cases testing out backup power or including sort of with the Nest bundle of technologies, the a package of solar power so that when there are those blackouts, there's a backup system.
Of the 17 technologies, some are commercially available. Others are either in clinical trials or in early prototypes. The goal is to eventually develop all the technologies, scale them, and roll them out, first in Malawi and eventually to other countries that need them. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Houston.
Well, musical artist Janet Jackson has just released a new single from her forthcoming album, her first in about 3 years. VOA Border Crossings host Larry London has details on the single Made for Now, and he talks about it with VOA's Steve Miller.
Donna Jackson, I'm coming!
Guess who's back? It's the youngest member of the Jackson family. Is back. At age 52, she's the youngest member of the Jackson family. Recent recipient of the Billboard Icon Award. Now she has a new song out, which means it won't be too long before we'll hear the 12th new album from Janet Jackson.
Get out. 12 albums?
12 albums.
It seems just like yesterday I was, you know, listening to her first album when I was in high school anyway. But man, that's amazing.
Yeah, she's been doing this for quite a while. In fact, she holds the record for most consecutive top 10 Billboard chart entries at 18. In 2008, Billboard listed Janet as number 7 on their Hot 100 all-time artist list. She was named 5th on the top R&B artist list of the last 25 years. And she's the second most successful dance music artist just behind Madonna. So today, for you, Steve, I brought in her brand new song, which is called Made for Now, and it features Daddy Yankee. Made for Now, Janet Jackson. She's been performing this on the award shows. She's been on the late night talk show circuit. The last time that she had an album out was 2015. It was called Unbreakable. And her last top 10 hit, 2001. That's a long time ago.
Yeah.
17 year stretch. Someone to Call My Lover with her then boyfriend, Jermaine Dupri. Now, Janet got married for the first time at age 18, which was 1984.
Mm-hmm.
She married James DeBarge. That marriage lasted a year. Then she married director Renee Elizondo in 1991. That marriage lasted 9 years, and in 2012 she married a billionaire from Qatar named Wissam Al-Manna. They had a son in 2017, Issa Al-Manna, but divorced about a year later. So she hasn't been doing well in the marriage world. There were allegations of abuse in that marriage, and so she's now raising her son and getting ready for a tour. Now, some of the past hits, I'm sure you'll remember these. Nasty.
That's the one I always remember because it has that definitive beat to it.
And Rhythm Nation.
Rhythm Nation.
And That's the Way Love Goes, Together Again, and All for You. So she is one of the big names in pop music history, and we're glad she's back with yet another single.
That's awesome. Anything else we need to know about Miss Jackson?
Well, she was Billboard's second most successful recording artist of the decade in the 90s, just behind Mariah Carey. Janet Jackson, Made for Now, the new single featuring Daddy Yankee.
Larry London is, of course, the host of VOA's Border Crossing Show. Larry, where can we find these?
Well, you can go to Facebook and find me at facebook.com/VOA Larry London. And you can check out Border Crossings at 1500 Universal on the VOA One Network.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show. But you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
New data was released at the July 2018 International AIDS Conference demonstrating the HIV epidemic is coming under control in Namibia. Results from the Namibia Population-Based HIV Impact Assessment show that 77% of all HIV-positive adults have achieved viral load suppression, a widely used measure of effective HIV treatment in a population. This surpasses the UN's target of 73% by 2020. Compared with the UN AIDS 2012 estimates, Namibia has reduced its adult HIV incidence rate by 50% in the past 5 years. Namibia has made this tremendous progress through the expansion of HIV prevention and treatment services, with a focus on viral load suppression at the individual and community level, and the swift implementation of forward-leading HIV policies. Women ages 15 to 24 still have a far higher HIV incidence rate than same-aged young men in Namibia. This highlights the continued need for expanded primary HIV prevention in young women and ensuring all HIV-infected men, particularly those ages 25 to 35, receive life-saving treatment and are virally suppressed. These exciting new data demonstrate that a community-centered approach results in high community viral suppression, which decreases the rates of new HIV infections, said Ambassador Deborah Birx, U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator and Special Representative for Global Health Diplomacy. She said several African countries are now on track to reach HIV epidemic control by 2020, accelerated progress that was only possible because of partner country political leadership and their rapid adoption of policies focusing primary prevention and treatment resources for maximum impact. Centers for Disease Control Director Robert Redfield said CDC continues to support Namibia's efforts to control its HIV epidemic, and we remain committed to global efforts to change the course of the HIV pandemic and help save lives. The population-based HIV impact assessments are funded by the U.S. government through PEPFAR and conducted by the CDC, ICAP at Columbia University, and local governmental and non-governmental partners. With PEPFAR support, 4 additional countries, Ethiopia, Haiti, Kenya, and Rwanda, will release HIV data on a rolling basis throughout 2019, providing an ability to chart and validate further progress toward reaching epidemic control by 2020. Together, said Dr. Birx, we are making the impossible possible, moving farther and faster toward ending AIDS as a public health threat by 2030.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.